Hello and welcome to the next episode of the FRCS Eurocast podcast. My name's Sophia, I'm a registrar in the East of England, and as ever, joined by my co-host, Harry.
Good evening, everyone. Harry Ratter, neurologist in Nottingham. Honestly, we've been overwhelmed with the response of friends and colleagues to our podcasts. Yeah, bizarrely, they seem to like it.
And we've had some requests for andrology, which seems to be a recurrent theme of things that people don't like and need to cover. So tonight, we are really thrilled to be joined by Mr. VB Modgill, based up in Manchester, consultant andrologist, who is going to set us straight on Peyronie's disease.
Oh, you had to get that one in, didn't you?
I did.
You've been working on that all day, I can tell.
Do you know what? That was a last-minute add-in, and I'm ashamed of it.
VB, welcome. I'm sure you've been on many podcasts, haven't you, in your illustrious career so far?
No. Well, firstly, thank you very much for having me. Secondly, bravo on this podcast, because as you quite rightly say, Harry, those of us who are now way post-exam have actually spent some time listening to them as well to jog our memories on a few things. So well done to both of you. And I did nearly leave after that pun from Sophia, but I'm going to stay. Yeah.
I think that's, I do apologise for my co-host's terrible jokes.
Right.
It's a bit out of character, actually, Sophia. Normally your jokes are good.
Yeah, normally I'm not that funny.
For new listeners, what we do is we look at a case of the kind that might well crop up in the exam, as well as in real life, of course. And we have chosen to look at this specific case of a 48-year-old man, and he's been referred to your andrology clinic for the past 3 months. He's been experiencing worsening penile pain during erections, and he's also noticed a worsening curvature of the penis. So he's now finding intercourse difficult due to the degree of curvature, but he's otherwise completely fit and well. So, VB, how would you approach this gentleman?
Okay, so I think the first thing to acknowledge here is the fact that the patient's given a really classical history for Peyronie's disease. And certainly in a Viva situation, I wouldn't hesitate to say that. There's not really much else that this can be. The other thing to acknowledge, of course, is the tremendous psychological impact that this disease has on men. It causes depression, it can cause relationship breakdowns, etc. So approach with sensitivity, appreciate that it's probably taken a huge psychological toll even before they walked in the room. And it's probably taken months, if not even years, for them to come and see you. In terms of a history, as ever, you're going to take a generalized history, but you're going to focus particularly on a few things. Disease duration, that's absolutely key. And we can come on to that a little bit later. But when did it start? How long exactly do they think it's been going on? And do try and narrow them down to months if you can, because that affects the management that you're going to offer them. Where is the pain? When does it come on? Is it there all the time? Or is it there during an erection? And again, pain is an important symptom and probably, other than the curvature, the most important complaint from a patient in these scenarios, because it tends to suggest that they're in the active phase of the disease, and we'll differentiate between the active and the stable phase a little bit later. Find out about the penile deformity. What is it? What is it that bothers them? And really spend time doing that. Normally, they'll describe a dorsal curvature, classically. Find out the angle. What do they think it is? And yes, okay, it might not fit with what it actually is when you look at pictures, etc. But you need to understand what the patient's perception of the disease is. Which way does it go? Is it just dorsal? Is it dorsolateral? Or is it perhaps even just shortening of the penis? Because plenty of men present to clinic with maybe not so much of a curvature, but that plaque formation has gradually shortened the penis. Is the penis stable? Can they use the penis? If so, for what? Can they masturbate? Can they ejaculate orgasm? Can they use it for penetrative intercourse? That is closely aligned, of course, to their definition of what function is. And so when you put that all together, what else does that leave you with? Probably the most important thing, erections, erectile strength. Okay. Simple way to ask that, and I often do it in clinic, is I say, imagine several years ago that your erections were straight enough and they were rigid, and actually sexual performance or your penis was no way in part of your thought process, because everything was just working as it should do. Those were 100% erections, 10 out of 10. What would you say they are now at best? And what are they, with or without tablets? Do you take tablets? It's really important to establish how good their erectile function is, because that, again, is going to have a really significant impact on the management of their disease.
Vivi,
now, generally,
just a quick question, really. So we often get letters from GPs who are reluctant to prescribe PDE5 inhibitors in men who they suspect have Peyronie's disease. And quite often it's a while before these chaps come up to andrology clinic. I mean, my understanding is it's perfectly safe for them to have PDE5 inhibitors.
It's completely safe. And again, we'll come on to this, but in terms of management of Peyronie's disease, one of the first things that you have to do is get the erection as good as you can get it. Because until you do that, you don't really know what you're going to do with the curvature aspect of it. Because in a man who doesn't develop strong enough erections for penetrative intercourse, the rate limiting factor is not the curvature. The rate limiting factor is the strength of the erection. And part of the history taking is to find out what the rate limiting factor is. It's about function. And if in your Peyronie's viva, you can keep at the forefront of your mind that all this is about function. The management of Peyronie's disease relies on either restoring or maintaining function. What's function? A function is a penis that's straight enough and rigid enough. Not either of those in isolation. You need both. Now, alongside that history, you can use questionnaires such as the IIEF or the SHIM score. Just remember, they're not validated in Peyronie's disease, but they can be useful.
Is there a Peyronie's disease questionnaire?
I don't think in a viva situation, I would expect perhaps a candidate to know that it exists, but I don't think, you know, it's more a research tool, really. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's used widely in clinics up and down the country. So the two questions, just to finish off in terms of the history that you need to ask is, if your erection was perfectly rigid, would the curve stop you from having intercourse? That's an important question. If your penis was perfectly straight, would the erection be rigid enough to have intercourse?
You mentioned, Vivi, about the importance of pain as a determinant of the active inflammatory phase of the condition. So what kind of time span does that usually take? I mean, my understanding is it's on average about a year worth of active phase. Is that still considered about right?
That's very reasonable, I think. It can be anything from six. You see patients up to 18 months still describing pain, still describing some involvement of their curvature or other disease characteristics, whether that be narrowing of the shaft of the penis or further shortening. So, but generally speaking, about a year or so, or you know, anywhere between 6 and 18 months.
Are there other diseases or medication that patient might be on that has been linked to development of Peyronie's?
There are associations with Dupuytren's contracture, for example. Now, in the reality of things, you're in an andrology clinic, or you've got a urological patient in front of you. So what if they've got Dupuytren's contracture? It's probably just something that confirms your diagnosis even further. So there's nothing really outside of the Peyronie's that you need to manage in the presence of that viva.
In terms of your physical examination in clinic, what specifically are you looking for?
Can you feel a plaque? If so, whereabouts? Remember, the vast majority of these are going to be dorsal and in and around the midline. Okay. Be wary. If somebody ever describes a ventral curvature to you, chances are it's not Peyronie's disease. It's congenital curvature. Mm-hmm. amongst other diagnoses. So if you can't feel a plaque, you've got to think, why can't I feel one? Is this Peyronie's disease? Because there should be one there. The other things to document is the patient circumcised. That has implications on whether or not you're going to perform that when you do the surgery to correct the curvature. What about the documented stretch penile length? That's really important. And remember, this disease process and managing these patients is litigious for obvious reasons, because the risks involved in operating on these patients include things like erectile dysfunction, penile shortening. You know, the penis can change quite substantially. And so documenting stretch penile length is important. And we in Manchester have devised our own sort of assessment aid for them so that they can go home and do it themselves. So, and for anyone who hasn't done it, It simply involves pulling the glands up into the air with the patient lying supine and measuring the distance between the penopubic junction and the coronal sulcus.
Mm-hmm. So you don't take the measurement to the glands, you do it to the sulcus.
The reason I do it to the sulcus is because there can be variation in glands.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that in order to be able to hold the penis properly and pull it into the air, if you can hold the glands completely, it tends to provide, in my experience, a more consistent measurement. Now, there's no right or wrong on how you measure it. Do it the same way every time, preoperatively, intraoperatively, postoperatively, so that you get consistent measurements throughout. And sometimes I actually make the patient hold the ruler, and all I do is pull the patient is pull the penis up into the air and say, "You tell me what you think it is."
In terms of measuring the angle, how do you do that?
So again, the other thing that we've done is devised a tool and a video to show them how to take digital pictures. Mm-hmm. Now, historically, injecting patients was very much the in vogue thing to do. A couple of issues with that. You need to find a room to be able to give the patient an injection. It's not a natural environment, so the patient isn't really going to develop an erection that they would do in a sort of normal personal situation. The other problem with that is, on occasion, particularly when we do the operation, when we do artificial erection testing, we can hyperinflate the penis and therefore accentuate the degree of curvature. So what do you want to know? And this goes back to that magic word in Peyronie's, function. You want to know what their functional curvature looks like, because you don't want to overcorrect it, you don't want to undercorrect it, and you want to see what it's like for them. The best way of doing that is digital photography. Mm-hmm. And so get them to go home, take a good quality digital picture, a white wall in the background in the four axis. So, you know, top down, left to right to left, and bottom up with a white wall in the background, good lighting. And then you can sit down with the patient and make an objective assessment of that.
And what about the guys with ED that don't get erections at home?
Well, then you've got a significant issue there. So then we go back to the discussion about optimizing their erectile function first. Mm-hmm. So the first thing you're going to do with those people is say, do all the things you'd normally do for ED, lifestyle modification, you know, don't smoke, drink less, lose weight, reduce your abdominal circumference, get healthy. That doesn't work. PDE5 inhibitors on a maximum dose, at least 8 tries in an appropriate setting, taking them in the right way, depending on what the tablet is, you know, making sure they're starved if it's an on-demand sildenafil tablet, or if they're taking a daily dose of tadalafil 5 milligrams once daily, then take that in the morning and let, you know, nature take its course. If that doesn't work, then you're going to go down to vacuum or traction devices. You know, if that doesn't work, topical treatments, injectable treatments. If none of that works, then to be honest, you've got your answer. Mm-hmm. Because now you're looking at a patient who's got end-stage erectile dysfunction, which isn't responsive to any of the non-surgical management. And therefore, you're going to deal with the curvature and the erectile dysfunction with a penile implant.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Great.
Is it mandatory, VB, to do a digital rectal examination and check their PSA and such like?
I don't routinely do that for these patients. If the patient doesn't complain of symptoms and it's purely a Peyronie's presentation, then no, I don't think there is.
In terms of what you can do in clinic then, you've taken a really thorough history. You've documented a very clear examination. Hopefully the patient's been asked to bring some photos so you got an idea of the real-world situation. Are there any other tests that you would do there and then, or does it then move on to trying to manage the problem?
It basically moves on to trying to manage the problem. In saying that, you need to see the pictures. Hmm. And the pictures need to be of a good enough quality, and you need to be confident enough that you and the patient are on the same page about what the nature of the problem is. If you are not, that's where you're going to go to additional tests. So things like penile Doppler scanning, you know, to measure the systolic and diastolic values. And I only really ever do that in one specific scenario, and I'll come on to that later. But if you've got doubts about, for example, narrowing or wasting or an hourglass deformity of the penis, instantly, your patient goes into the complex curvature category. So therefore, you might need imaging such as an MRI scan in the presence of an alprostadil injection. The other things that you need to be really careful about in the history and in the examination, or even when you're looking at their pictures, is things like distal flaccidity. So patients can describe a phenomenon where the shaft is rigid up until the point of the plaque formation. And beyond that, they simply don't get enough rigidity to be able to have penetrative intercourse. What that means is the penis no longer has the axial rigidity that's required for them to be able to have intercourse. And therefore, if you do a tunicle shortening procedure or you try and put graft material in there, you're not going to restore function in that penis, because the only thing that's going to produce uniform shaft rigidity throughout that penis is going to be a penile implant.
Mm. So let's come back to our hypothetical gentleman then. So we've said that he is only a few months into the process and he's still getting pain. So we can assume that there's still active inflammation. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, remember, no one really knows what causes peritonitis disease, but we think that it is an inflammatory process, mixture of impaired wound healing, reactive oxygen species activation, and it, you know, plus minus micro trauma or tunicle tearing that causes it. But we don't really know what it causes. But yeah, you're quite right. Yeah.
But this is the kind of stuff you tell patients that, you know, clearly it's going to take a while for the inflammation to settle. So he's obviously anxious because he's wondering whether there's anything you can do to shorten the duration of the active phase or anything to reduce the ultimate deformity. So do you use any prescribed medicine for that?
If the patient is describing anything but really, really good erectile strength, so 100% erectile strength, there's no harm at all in putting them on a PDE5 inhibitor. And if you look at the latest EAU guidelines, there is some evidence to suggest that using a PDE5 inhibitor, such as a once daily formulation, tadalafil 5 milligrams once daily to optimize the erections, is a good thing for the patient. The other thing that I do in my practice as well is put them on a traction device in order to try and preserve length. The other thing I find in real life terms is that, remember, they're incredibly distressed. And, you know, historically, what have we done with these people? They've walked into the clinic room really distressed. We say, okay, it's only 6 months. You're in the active phase.
Go away for a bit.
Yeah, which doesn't mean much to them. How many other urological processes do we say, or any process, disease process, do we say to a patient, yeah, I hear you. I'm sure it's really upsetting for you. Come and see me in 9 months. It's not great for the patient. So actually, you know, tablet therapy, such as a PDE5 inhibitor or traction therapy, and a deeper understanding of the disease and, you know, explaining why they're coming back in 6 to 9 months, that helps in the active phase.
Is there anything that's in particular they can do for the pain aspect of it?
Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Mm-hmm. So there is no other evidence, and I may as well say it now, there is no evidence for oral therapy in Peyronie's disease. Pitaba, vitamin E, tamoxifen, I mean, there's a long list, isn't there? It doesn't exist, to the best of my knowledge. And if somebody listens to this podcast and comes back and can educate me otherwise, then fair enough. But and we'll have to go back and record the whole thing. But I'm certainly not, I'm not aware of it at all, no. Yeah. So non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, there is some evidence for shockwave treatment in improving pain for patients in Peyronie's disease.
But that, does it affect the curvature, or is it just pain element?
No,
that
no. Fine. The evidence that exists for shockwave treatment is for pain in Peyronie's disease and vasculogenic ED.
Okay.
And that is it. In all other forms at the moment, it's experimental.
And what do you tell them about the likely natural progression of Peyronie's? Like, what percentage-ish are there figures you quote for who stabilizes, who gets worse, if any get better?
So, generally speaking, natural history wise, very few of them will get better. You're talking less than 15%. I think the figure off the top of my head is somewhere between 10 and 13%. Around 40, 50% of them certainly will progress. And some of them will stay stable.
We've successfully addressed the question of medical therapy in that there is none that works. So we've sent him away then with some NSAIDs for his pain and possibly some PDE5 inhibitors if his erections aren't top-notch. And you'd presumably typically see them again a few months later with some up-to-date pictures and obviously go through another thorough history to work out their functioning. But let's say he comes back and he says, look, you know, the PDE5 inhibitors have given me decent erections now, and I think the pain's settled and the deformity hasn't worsened for the past few weeks. Our kind of supposition is that they've entered the quiescent stage of the disease. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. And just remind me, Harry, at what stage does the patient come back?
So let's say he comes back 6 months later. So it's about a year after the initial onset of symptoms.
So he comes back a year later and things have obviously stabilized. What do you want to know? Effectively, you want to know exactly the same things you wanted to know the first time. Function. If the patient comes back and says, I can have intercourse, I can masturbate, I can orgasm, ejaculate, that's function. And to that patient, I would say, okay, you're young. If you're functioning, you don't need us. You don't need anything doing.
Well, you can't make him much better, can you, I guess?
Well, you could have marginal gains in terms of you could improve his curvature, but it's like anything we do, it's a risk stratification. So the patient has to fully understand the risks that are involved in trying to do that. So, you know, we have this at andrological conferences every year where, you know, somebody will say, okay, you've got a 40 or a 35 degree curvature. It doesn't look great. It bothers you psychologically slightly, but you can function with it. How many of you want an operation? And it is extremely rare to see even a single hand go up, because that's the reality of what people who know about Peyronie's disease operating would want. And if they say, no, actually, I might be functioning, but it's really uncomfortable, or positionally, it's very difficult, or it's painful for my partner, or it's having a huge psychological impact on me, and I appreciate all of the risks that go with the procedure that you're proposing, but nonetheless, I wish to undergo it. Those are reasonable reasons to operate on somebody. If we move on slightly to the sort of in terms of management of these patients, well, what is it? So A, do nothing. B, put them on a traction device and see how they get on. And some patients will come back and say, actually, I'm okay with the traction device. You've optimized my erection with, say, a PDE5 inhibitor. I feel a lot better. I don't need anything else. C, you've got the patient with a 45 to normally around 60 degree curvature, but probably no more than that, in whom you are going to offer a tunicle shortening procedure. And remember, functionality isn't a straight penis. We know that men with a residual curvature of 25 degrees or so will function okay. So it's not about getting it as straight as possible. I will operate on men with a 60 degree curvature and still offer them a tunicle shortening procedure with the aim of getting them down to, say, 25 to 30 degrees. Because I know that if I do that, they're going to have less length loss. And then you've got the patient who will fall into the excellent erections category, but with a complex curvature. And for the purposes of the exam, we've always talked about complex curvatures being 60 degrees or over. Now, in the reality of life, you don't suddenly offer a patient with a 58 degree curvature one operation and another for the 62 degree curvature patient. It is always a spin-off between the operation that's going to preserve your erections and the operation that's going to reduce length loss. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, so, you know, who are you going to do a tunicle lengthening procedure on? You're going to do it for a patient, generally speaking, but not always, with a curvature of 60 degrees or less. In a patient who is prepared to tolerate length loss, with no hourglass or other complexity adding to the picture, because you're not going to do a plication procedure on someone with an hourglass deformity. You'll destabilize the penis further. Who are you going to do for example, plaque incision and grafting procedure, which is a completely different beast. And that's called, it's never called a tunicle lengthening procedure. And I don't like that term, because as soon as you say lengthening to a patient, that's the only word that they've heard by the time they've left your room. And they've now left thinking, this is great, my penis is going to be longer. It's not. It's a length preservation procedure at best. And despite that, you can still get shortening with it. So who is that for? Well, that's for patients with a perfect erection. Why is that? When you do tunicle shortening procedures, the risk of erectile dysfunction should be less than 5%, I would say. The risk of erectile dysfunction when you put artificial graft material on top of the corpora, as you do in a plaque incision and grafting procedure, is around 20% or even more in certain cases. So if the patient walks in and says to you, their erections are anything but perfect, you shouldn't be attempting a grafting procedure for that patient.
Is that perfect on PDE5 or perfect au naturel?
Really good question. Really good question. So if they say they're perfect on PDE5, I would still have some trepidation. And that's where counseling is absolutely key. So you would say to them, well, your erections aren't quite perfect because at the moment you're using a pharmacological agent in order to help. I'm going to do an operation on you, which carries a really, really significant risk of erectile dysfunction, despite it being, you know, even if the operation is the most beautifully done operation, that risk will not go away. And therefore, you're at a higher risk of erectile dysfunction than the patient who's not on PDE5 inhibitors. And if you have any doubt before a grafting procedure about whether or not, if there's something in the history that gets your ears twigging, or you think maybe the erections aren't as good as the patient thinks they are, that's when you get an ultrasound Doppler to check the arteriogenic and the venogenic function within the penis. Because if the arteriogenic function is nothing but perfect, or the venous system isn't behaving as it should do, then alarm bells should ring. Because after, by the time you've incised the true tunic albuginea and put an artificial material in there, whatever that artificial material may be, you are probably really going to compromise the erectile strength of that penis.
And Vivi, I know it's within the realms of very subspecialist andrology practice, and you know, plaque incision and grafting is not something that most of the Viva candidates may have seen or be familiar with, but what material do you use for grafting?
The most widely used material in the UK at the moment is still bovine pericardial patch. And there are several materials that can be used. Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a fair question for a candidate to be asked. You just need to know that there's different ones that exist. You know, historically, people used to use saphenous vein grafts, cadaveric pericardium. There's a material called pelvicol that can be used. There's a new kid on the block called Tacacil, which you don't have to stitch in. It's by the by. You have to know the principles of the procedure. And what does that involve? Broadly speaking, you have to lift the neurovascular bundle off the tunica, find the plaque, break it, so that the penis can be restored to its original length. And when you do that and you break it, the two ends of it split apart and that leaves a gap in the middle. You have to then put a patch on that gap, put the neurovascular bundle back down, put bucks back over it, pull the skin up, and you're done.
And for the plication cases, what technique do you tend to use?
So plications are done in lots of different ways, but I think the commonest plication procedure most candidates will have heard about is a Nesbitt procedure. Mm-hmm. So that simply involves, again, several different techniques. I suspect the commonest one is still this: deglove the penis, make a circumcoronal incision, drop that skin down, and then perform an artificial erection test to find the maximal point of curvature. I use a pen a lot when I do these. And once I've marked the maximal point of curvature, I create two windows, mobilizing the Buck's fascia from medial, so paraurethral medial to lateral on both sides. I then make a diamond shape with my pen on both sides, making sure it's in the same place, excise the tunicle layer, and then close with a PDS stitch. The commonest cause of Peyronie's surgery failure is suture failure. Nice strong throws, several throws, and try and bury the stitch if you can, and then put it all back as you found it.
Can I briefly ask, because I think we'll probably cover implants in detail when we do a podcast on erectile dysfunction. But do you have an implant of choice you use? Is it always inflatables for these, or can you use either or?
Again, it comes back to patient choice. So where I am in Manchester, I think malleables probably account for less than 0.5% of our practice. The vast majority of them are inflatable devices, because these are men that are generally fit, well, don't have an issue with dexterity. They want the advantage of being able to conceal the device as and when they wish, but again, you know, use it to its maximum potential. So who's the implant for? Well, the implant's for patients with erectile dysfunction that doesn't respond to all the other therapies that we previously mentioned. Who else is it for? It's for patients who may have a reasonable erectile function, but don't want to take the risks of a plaque incision and grafting, and would rather they have a procedure that deals with both rigidity and some resolution of the curvature in one sitting. In a Viva situation, you just need to know how to describe an implant, or sometimes you can be asked to draw an implant as well. Mm-hmm. And broadly speaking, two cylinders that sit in the corpora, a pump that sits in the scrotum, and a reservoir that sits somewhere in the abdomen, and there are variations on where it sits in the abdomen. When you squeeze the pump, the fluid leaves the reservoir, makes its way down the tubing into the cylinders, and the penis becomes rigid. I always say this to every time we talk on either Peyronie's or ED, do not describe a penile implant as giving you an erection. That's not what it does. And if somebody was to pull you up on it afterwards, or a patient was to feel disappointed, they would probably be just in doing so. All an implant does is it gives you uniformed shaft rigidity when you want, as many times as you want, as long as you want.
Can I ask about one thing we haven't talked about, which is collagenase injections?
So you make a really good point, and I might have forgotten it had you not, so thanks for that, Sophia. Collagenase injections absolutely are very relevant, and I think of them as a disease-modifying therapy. So this comes on the back of the BJUI paper in 2018, I think, from Prof. Ralph's group, and it's Clostridium histolyticum from memory, and they basically are injected into the plaque, following which the penis is then modeled. And there are different regimes that can be offered. Again, I don't think you need to have a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of that. You just need to know that it exists. The average improvement in curvature that they had shown was around 17 degrees. Now, why is that relevant? Well, it's relevant because a chap with a 45 degree curvature, if you can take it down by almost 20 degrees, well, guess what? You've taken them from non-functioning to functioning. They don't need an operation. Why else might it be relevant? If you've got somebody with a 60 or 70 degree curvature and you take it down to, I don't know, 50 or 45 or somewhere around there, well, actually, you've taken them from potentially a plaque incision and grafting to a plication procedure or a tunical shortening procedure with a much more favorable side effect profile.
Vivi, I'm very ignorant of the injections, because certainly when I was studying for the exam, it was something that was very experimental rather than something that was used in routine clinical practice. So two questions for me. So number one, what phase of the disease would you use it in? And secondly, is it available on the NHS now, or is it something that's just...
Second question, much easier. It's not available on the NHS. Currently, it's not available in the UK, full stop. So we can't get a hold of it, which is difficult for patients. And then the other thing is I would use it in the stable phase, Harry, just like I would with any other invasive intervention.
No, that's very clear. So something to be aware of, although perhaps not so relevant for UK practice at the moment.
At the moment, but of course, it could, you know, we may find next month it's back, in which case it's very relevant.
Thank you, Vivi. That is extremely clear. And I have to say, you've done amazingly well at simplifying a seemingly quite complex topic. And I guess that the main message again and again is that we just need to listen to our patients, particularly in these conditions which really do affect their quality of life and their mental health, as you have so eloquently said. So thank you once again for joining us. I know you're coming back to talk about ED in a few episodes' time, aren't you? So we'll look forward to
absolutely, yeah,
to hearing all about that.
Yeah, we'd agreed on formally now, so you tied in.
I mean, I'm going from no podcast to two in quick succession. I've made it. I'm on the Sophia and Harry podcast.
You've definitely made it, mate, and we really appreciate your expertise. I think that just about wraps us up for this episode, Sophia.
Yeah, great. Thank you both very much for spending your evening talking about this, and we'll see you next time, Vivi.
Thanks, guys. Thanks very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.